instead of just telling you early church tradition says this about Mark or whatnot, I decided I'll just go ahead and give it to you so we can read it together and then you can look at it more at home. We won't read it all. Also attached to that are two other things that actually are not related to the general church traditions about the Gospel of Mark. We will get to those whenever we start talking about Mark 1:1. So we are beginning our study of Mark. I believe I'm going to be taking us through 20. Then Edward will take us from 21 to the end of the chapter. And at that point, we'll be having a contest to see who can eat the most wings. And whoever wins will get the first part of chapter 2. So I'll be starting us off today. The goal is to introduce you to the gospel generally and then to get as far as I can through the introductory material, which is 1:1 through 1:19. The Gospel of Mark, depending on who you ask, was either the first or usually the second and occasionally the third gospel written. It's surprising how interesting of a question that turns out once you get into it later in the gospel. But it's not really something we're going to deal with extensively at all. I'm just going to go on the assumption right now, which is the majority assumption, which is Mark was written first. So Mark, as the first gospel, as I believe we mentioned the other day, was probably written sometime in the AD 60s area. This is before the big momentous event of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and right around the death of Peter, which becomes pretty important in the traditions about the composition of the Gospel of Mark. So what you have here is you have everything but the last two statements are pieces of history from the early church. You have the anti-Marcionite prologue to the Gospel of Mark. Has anybody read that before? Okay, good. It's pretty interesting. The Monarchian prologue to the Gospel of Mark, we won't read that. That's just for your benefit later on. Next is, or are, some quotations from the father of church history, Eusebius, followed by a selection from Irenaeus. Now, the Roman numeral in the far right, in parentheses, that's the century that these roughly came from. So let's start with the anti-Marcionite prologue to the Gospel of Mark. Mark made his assertion, who was also named Stubby Fingers, on account that he had, in comparison to the length of the rest of his body, shorter fingers. He was a disciple and interpreter of Peter, whom he followed just as he heard him report. When he was requested at Rome by the brethren, he briefly wrote this gospel, Mark, in parts of Italy. When Peter heard this, he approved and affirmed it by his own authority for the reading of the church. Truly, after the departure of Peter, this gospel, which he himself put together, having been taken up, he went away into Egypt and ordained as the first bishop of Alexandria, announcing Christ, he constituted a church there. It was of such teaching and continence of life that it compels all followers of Christ to imitate its example. So the anti-Marcionite prologue to the Gospel of Mark is a prologue in some of the earlier Latin manuscripts of the New Testament. What is the well-known Latin translation of the New Testament and Old Testament? What do we know that by? The Vulgate, right. That was done by Jerome. These are actually in the Latin translations previous to the Vulgate, because the Vulgate was not the first. That was written in a reaction to multiple different Latin translations and something of a confusion of what a good Latin translation of the Bible would be. So Jerome wrote his own translation, and that's what the church standardized, at least the Western church, standardized on. So this prologue is found in manuscripts from that older Latin tradition. People generally date this to the second century. Now, they call this the anti-Marcionite prologue to the Gospel of Mark, not because it has anything anti-Marcionite in it. As you notice, there really isn't much of, they're not really critiquing anyone in this little piece of text, are they? They call it that because there are other anti-Marcionite prologues. These form a group. And some of the other prologues to other books in the New Testament are very explicitly saying Marcion, the second century heretic, was in fact wrong. So what does this tell us about Mark? This is one of our earliest traditions that we have. Well, it says that he has short fingers, which is a very important thing to know, right? So instead of calling this Mark, we may just call him Stubby Fingers for the rest of this study. I'm not going to do that. That'd be strange. What it does say here is very important, that Mark got his material from Peter. And that is the consistent and very important part of this tradition. And that we'll see this in other ones as well. Mark did not know Jesus, as far as we can tell. There's no really good reason to say he ever met him, he ever saw him, or ever heard him. It's possible, but he was certainly not one of the disciples. And as far as the development of the New Testament canon, most of the books of the New Testament came from either apostles or those who were very close associates. John Mark was obviously a very close associate, and we will see him in the New Testament in a minute. So this is what the anti-Marcionite prologue says. It says that he was basically requested by the church under Peter's supervision to write this gospel. And when he wrote it, Peter said, "I approve this message," essentially. I'll leave you to read the Monarchian prologue to the Gospel of Mark. Monarchianism is a heresy in the early church, but the prologue is interesting. Eusebius. And if you ever want to read Eusebius' classical history, there's a book. It's actually fairly cheap, done by Hendrickson. You can get your own copy. The only negative thing about it is it doesn't have the original Greek, but, you know, that makes it less cool, but it's still a nice translation. I got mine for, I think, $10, $13 at Half Price Books. Let's read a little bit of that. Let's read the first selection. Papias, who is a very interesting figure, very enigmatic. We don't actually have any of his writings, but he was a very famous second century Christian father. Papias gives also in his own work other accounts of the words of the Lord on the authority of Aristian. So what Eusebius is doing here is he's quoting Aristian, who is quoting Papias. Skip down to 15, the next paragraph. "This also the presbyter said," and this is Papias talking about the elder, the presbyter, who is theoretically the Apostle John, who was supposedly Papias' apostle, pastor. "This is what the presbyter, John, said. Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not in order," that's interesting, "whatsoever he remembered of the things said or done by Christ, for he neither heard the Lord nor followed him. But afterward, as I said, he followed Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers, but with no intention of giving a connected account of the Lord's discourses, so that Mark committed no error while he thus wrote some things as he remembered them. For he was careful of one thing, not to omit any of the things which he had heard, and not to state any of them falsely. These things are related by Papias concerning Mark." So as far as Eusebius is concerned, and also Papias, Mark wrote down the Gospel of Mark from Peter's remembrances. He wasn't trying to lay all of the events in order. He wasn't trying to give a historical account of Jesus. This is a collection of stories of events in Jesus' life for the church in Rome. And then Peter was ultimately the source of that. There's another selection from Ecclesiastical History. I will let you read that at your leisure. It's a little bit longer and has more interesting material. So Eusebius wrote in the 4th century. He's reaching back to traditions from the 2nd century. And so assuming Eusebius' information is correct, he's going back to the 2nd century with that as well. And so then, Irenaeus is against heresies. Another 2nd century work. "We have learned from none others the plan of our salvation than from those through whom the gospel has come down to us, which they did at one time proclaim in public, and, at a later period, by the will of God, handed down to us in the scriptures, to be the ground and pillar of our faith. For it is unlawful to assert that they preached before they possessed perfect knowledge, as some do even venture to say, boasting themselves as approvers of the apostles. For, after our Lord rose from the dead, the apostles were invested with power from on high when the Holy Spirit came down upon them, were filled with all his gifts, and had perfect knowledge. They departed to the ends of the earth, preaching the glad tidings of the good things sent from God to us, and proclaiming the peace of heaven to men, who indeed do all equally and individually possess the gospel of God." So now here's his tradition about the writing of the Gospels. "Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect, while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. Luke, also the companion of Paul, recorded in a book the gospel preached by him. Afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who also had leaned upon his breast, did himself publish a gospel during his residence at Ephesus in Asia. And so as far as the dating is concerned for the Gospel of Mark, there's actually quite a bit of debate on something in line, 4 from the top. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us. So there's quite a bit of debate on what departure means. The word there is exodus. Does it mean after they left Rome on a trip somewhere else, or does it mean their death? It could actually mean either one. And as far as dating is concerned, that's actually fairly important. Is it closer to AD 70, or is it closer to AD 60? If it's after their death, it's later. If it's before their death, meaning they left, then it's before. Early church tradition very firmly has Peter in Rome. Now, Butner's point is a good one. There is no explicit scripture. There is a statement that Peter is writing from Babylon. But you need to ask, what is Babylon at that point? Is Babylon Rome, Babylon the harlot, or is Babylon Jerusalem? And frankly, either one of them fit. Early church tradition, it depends on where you're going to find, really, depend on your evidence. The New Testament is somewhat sketchy in terms of where people are when. Right? Peter was the apostle to Jerusalem. He did spend most of his time there. Do we know from the New Testament events whether or not he ever left Jerusalem to go to, say, Rome? Well, the New Testament doesn't really say, right? So it's kind of hard to say exactly where someone was at any given point unless there's actually commentary on it. So what some Reformed folk will do, for example, Butner, is they will focus on Peter not being in Rome. Why? Because, somebody tell me. Why is it important for Peter not to be in Rome? He couldn't be the first pope in Rome if he's not in Rome, right? Is that true? I don't really know. Tradition, though, is very clear. Tradition has Peter in Rome, and it's not just these. There's an early document, I can't remember which one it is, where there's essentially a duel between Simon Magus and Peter in Rome, where Simon's doing various miracles, and then Peter's beating all of his miracles. So, you know, Peter is the new Moses, while Simon is the priest of Pharaoh. And, you know, you've got Simon flying at one point, and you've got Peter shooting him down. It's a little strange. But there are multiple traditions, and these are just some of them, that have Peter in Rome. And it is remarkably consistent. And it is an interesting, important question, not only just for the church historical point of where did the authority of Rome come from. It's also pretty significant for interpretation as well. I believe Reagan argued in his thesis that Babylon was to be construed with Jerusalem, not Rome. And on that basis, you have to say that Peter's own saying that he is in Babylon is actually saying, when he wrote the epistles, I'm in Jerusalem. What is the answer? I don't know. Tradition very clearly puts him in Rome. But that's the thing about traditions. If traditions don't agree with you, you're not going to pass it on. So is this a case of they just didn't pass on the things that they didn't agree with? But then again, Irenaeus doesn't really have a bone to pick on this matter. There's, as far as I can tell, no particular reason to think Irenaeus thought that the Pope was in Rome, because the idea of a pope at the time didn't exist. There were multiple bishops. And the bishop of Rome was important because that's where Peter was. But it's not like there was the bishop in Rome and then there was everybody else. That's not a development you see that early. The tradition is that Matthew originally wrote in Aramaic. As a general rule, when they said Hebrew, they didn't really know the difference between Aramaic and Hebrew. But he was probably actually saying Matthew wrote his gospel first in Aramaic, and then it would have been translated later. Now, that is also a problematic tradition, because we don't have any copies of Matthew in Aramaic. Really, the best way to tell if a document is translated from another is to compare, well, here's a copy in this one language, and here's a copy in this language. Which one makes more sense? Does it make sense that this Greek would be translated from this Aramaic because of the idioms in Aramaic, or does it make more sense the other way? Well, we don't have any copies. We have some copies that come from like the 4th or 5th century that are in Aramaic. But those are later. So that was the early tradition that Matthew originally wrote in Hebrew and then later translated into Greek. But by and large, that's denied by most scholars pretty much in every wing of scholarship today. They pretty much say, if Matthew did write something in Hebrew, it was something else. Matthew, the book, doesn't really show the signs of being a translation document. The general consensus is most Jews in the first century would have probably been bilingual. Their main language would have been Aramaic, and they would have probably known some Greek for trade. It's quite possible that some of them would have been, I guess, quadrilingual, because Aramaic would be in your everyday language. You would use Greek for trade. If you happen to be trained as a rabbi, you would be reading the scriptures sometimes in Hebrew in the synagogue. And if you're involved with law, you might know some Latin. But I would think that would be incredibly rare. If you were a Jew at the time writing a document for Jews, you would probably write in Aramaic. If not in Aramaic, you would write in Greek. There's very good reason to say you would not write in Hebrew, because by that time, Hebrew was probably something known primarily only by scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and whatnot. If you had a synagogue in Rome, you wouldn't be reading in Aramaic. That would be highly unlikely. If you've got a synagogue in Judea, I would think that that would probably be done in Aramaic. And so what we have in Luke, where we show Jesus reading from Isaiah, my guess is he was probably reading in Aramaic, not reading in Greek, and that everything that we have in the Gospels is a translation from Aramaic into Greek, then in English later. But then again, this is one of those reconstruction things where they take the evidence and they say, this is probably the case, but it is kind of hard to say for sure. For the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were written like 3rd century B.C. to 1st century A.D., you've got a mix of Hebrew and Aramaic. So by that time, clearly Aramaic was taking over. But you also see that anyway in the history of Israel, and that after the Babylonian captivity, Aramaic became such a much more common language for them, because Aramaic was the language of the day for the ancient Near East up until Alexander came through, and that's when Greek happened. And so you would have had, long before Jesus, a shift towards Aramaic as an everyday language for the Jews. When it really became predominant, that's a good question. I would imagine that all the epistles of Paul were written in Greek first. There is a very small group that would say that the entire New Testament was originally written in Aramaic. I find that incredibly improbable. It's possible that perhaps Matthew was originally written in Aramaic. That's defendable. To say that Luke was written in Aramaic originally, I don't really think you can make an argument for that, or Acts, or Paul's epistles. That actually doesn't make any sense for them. Because if Paul's writing to Asia Minor, that is going to be probably a Greek-speaking area. Where the Palestine area, that's where you'd have your Aramaic speakers. So I would find it highly unlikely that any of Paul's epistles were ever written in Aramaic. It is very possible that the Septuagint would have been read in the synagogues in Palestine. It's very possible. It's really just a matter of what percentage of people really knew Greek and used it as their everyday language. And as a general rule, the best way to tell that is to look at the distribution of the writings of a given period of time. Say, what were the everyday people of Palestine in the first century writing in? Were they writing in Aramaic, Hebrew, Latin, or Greek? The thing is, literacy rates were really low, and we don't have hardly any documents from the first century, so it's kind of hard to tell. But is it very possible? Yes. If there was scripture being read, it was probably in, there could have been maybe read in Hebrew, then interpreted in Aramaic, or possibly just read in Greek. And it might have depended from synagogue to synagogue. Who knows? Once you get outside of Palestine, though, you're outside of Aramaic land. I don't think people would have been speaking Aramaic at all in Asia Minor. And when you get west of that, there's no chance that people would have been speaking Aramaic in Greece or Rome. But in Palestine, who knows? Now, the issue of the Septuagint is an interesting one in that the tradition of the Septuagint is that, I think it was the 3rd century, that 70, well, actually a little more than 70, but 70, Septuagint is the Greek word for 70, 4th century, that they gathered in Alexandria. A group of Jewish scholars, brought them from Jerusalem to say, hey, we need a translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. And so through various miraculous things, the Septuagint was born, and that's the history of it. The actual history is probably more complicated than that, in that there probably wasn't a Septuagint. There was the Septuagint, which was the most, perhaps most widely used, but there were probably multiple different translations of the Hebrew Old Testament. And so what you get in the New Testament is you do get a wide usage of the Septuagint as we know it today. But you also get some writers, when you look at their Greek translations, you go, you know, that doesn't look like it's coming from the Septuagint. And then you have the other difficulty in this, in that what we have for the Septuagint is primarily coming from the 3rd and 4th century AD. So whenever you do get the quotations of the Septuagint in the New Testament, are they originally as they were in the 1st century, or were they assimilated to the Septuagint text that grew in the 2nd and 3rd century in Christian usage? It's a very complicated thing, and I'm not sure anybody really knows the answers to that. But as a general rule, the Christian Bible was the Greek Old Testament, and it's generally called the Septuagint. The Christian church did not pick up this Aramaic culture. Even though it did come out of Palestine, they did not try to push an Aramaic culture on Rome, for example, which I think is a very interesting missionary point. What was more important to them were the teachings of what the apostles said and the teachings of Jesus in his life. They didn't need to say, okay, you need to eat these certain things so much, or you need to obey these particular laws in this particular way. It was the message that was a little more, hopefully quite a bit more important than the Jewish culture at the time. The New Testament textual tradition preserved is quite solid. Even though we don't have any manuscripts from before the 2nd century, we have no record of any major variation in any book outside of Luke and Acts. And in Luke and Acts, it's a few additions that don't really change the meaning of the book anyway. Seriously, in Matthew, there are no alternative traditions. This is not true for some other things. For example, if you compare the Greek text of Jeremiah to the Hebrew text of Jeremiah, you'll see a good many differences. But you can't say, here's Matthew in this one tradition, and here's Matthew in this other tradition, and look how vastly different they are. You can't do that. It is surprising the unanimity when you get to the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century of the textual traditions. And so when people talk about variants as you go through history, it's really actually surprisingly minor. So that's another good point to throw out as well. But Howe's point is very valid. There are discrepancies between the Greek text used by Paul and the Greek text used by the author of Hebrews and what we find in the Hebrew text of today. And also, since we're on the subject, throw this in as well, the Hebrew text we use today for most of our Old Testaments is actually from the 8th century AD. It wasn't until the Dead Sea Scrolls that we went back to around 2nd and 3rd century BC for our Hebrew text. And for various reasons, up until now, nobody's really tried to create a critical text of meshing the two together. So often the Septuagint, the Greek version that the New Testament writers are quoting, is actually more ancient than what we have as the basis of our Old Testament. Does that make sense? And so in some cases you can look at that and go, okay, I see what's in the Septuagint, and I see what's in our Hebrew text. Actually, what we have in our Septuagint is older than this text, which is 800 years older. So, excuse me, younger than the Septuagint. So it's an interesting little bit. So those are the early traditions. Let me see if I can gather in my head exactly where we are in this conversation, since we've been somewhat derailed. Okay, so we've got Mark written sometime in the 60s, right? We've got Mark probably written by a fellow named Mark, and this is specifically John Mark. And I forgot my watch, by the way, so I really have no idea what time it is. We're good? All right. Let's take a little look at John Mark. So turn to Acts. Now, there's some theories that Mark might have been the man who ran away naked, and I believe it's the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Those are just theories. This is where we first get our... he ran away naked, not because he was a streaker, but somebody grabbed his clothes and he needed to get out of there. You get an interesting story about Mark. So we see from the traditions, Mark was a very important figure in early Christian history. He became a missionary to Alexandria, and a big church grew up there. And we know Christianity was quite big in Egypt, both in its heretical forms in Gnosticism and also in its Orthodox forms. So Mark would have been a major Orthodox force in Egypt. So what do we know about Mark? Mark is also known as John and also known as John Mark. Acts 12:11. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from everything the Jewish people were expecting to happen." When Peter realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many people had gathered together and were praying. So this is our first definite mention of the fellow. Later in the chapter, verse 25. So Barnabas and Saul returned to Jerusalem when they had completed their mission, bringing along with them John Mark. So this is a promising fellow. He is apparently zealous for the faith. So Barnabas and Saul bring them along with them. Now go to the next chapter, chapter 13, verse 13. Then Paul and his companions put out to sea from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia, but John left them and returned to Jerusalem. John left them. This is John Mark. Well, what kind of leave? He just decided, "I'm tired. I need to go take care of my house." What was it? Well, you find out in Acts 15, 38. Start 36. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's return and visit the brothers in every town where we proclaim the word of the Lord to see how they are doing." Barnabas wanted to bring John, called Mark, along with them too, but Paul insisted that they should not take along this one who had left them in Pamphylia and had not accompanied them in the work. So this was not a nice leaving. This is not a, "Well, he has just some other work to do." This is a, "When John Mark left us, it was wrong." Perhaps he was scared for his life because of the persecutions. Perhaps he was more concerned, perhaps, with things of this world in Paul's mind. Whatever the reason was, John Mark left, and Paul was very upset about it. Barnabas, being the fellow who doesn't mind taking people in who've had issues in the past, including Paul, Barnabas takes him, and they go off to Cyprus, where Paul goes his separate ways, and they have their own split. What's interesting is, go to Colossians 4:10. Is Mark does not disappear off the Pauline radar. Colossians 4:10. "Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you greetings, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him." So you see, by the time of the writing Colossians, Mark is apparently back in Paul's good favor for some reason. Now turn to 2 Timothy 4:11. This is Paul in Rome, imprisoned, writing to Timothy. "Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, because he is a great help to me in ministry." And so you've got the story of Mark. We don't get a lot of information about it, but it's pretty interesting. You've got Mark early on, who is apparently very interested in the faith, a believer. So Paul and Barnabas are like, "We'll bring him on." But for whatever reason, we do not know, John Mark abandons them on their missionary journey. Later on, Barnabas wants to bring him along. Paul says, "No way." Barnabas takes him. But later on in Paul's life, you've got Paul saying, "Okay, this Mark guy, he is very..." What did he say here? "He is a very great help to me in ministry." And so you've got this change in John Mark. And then, of course, the tradition goes along that he then was with Peter. And you see also mentions of him in 1 Peter 13. He was with Peter in Rome, according to the tradition. And then he went, wrote the gospel, then went to Alexandria as a, I think he was actually called a bishop of Alexandria. And so you've got this very interesting figure in the early church. And it's beside the point, but it's an interesting point to see that there are failures, and failures are bad. But we ought to remember that sometimes people who fail can get back up and do something very significant, as is the case of Mark. So that is the grace of God. There is sin, but there is also forgiveness and mercy. So when someone sins, we should discipline them, but we should look for repentance and look for fruit and accept them when we see that.
And Paul could have been wrong.
And Paul could have been wrong. That is, wait, whoa, you can't say it. Yeah. True. Barnabas apparently took the better way, as we see what happened from Mark. So let's see. So we've got the Gospel of Mark written in the 60s by probably a guy named Mark. Now, this is tradition. We don't have in verse 1 the beginning of the Gospel of Mark about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It doesn't say that if you look. It just says the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The title for this, as well as the title for all the Gospels, were not, as far as we know, originally attached to them. Now, we're fairly sure Luke probably wrote Luke, especially with Acts. You tie them together, you've got that pretty solid. John? Well, a lot of people think John wrote John. Some people don't. Matthew, it's kind of hard to tell because there's really nothing in the Gospel that ties Matthew to that Gospel. But church tradition is very consistent that Matthew wrote Matthew. Now, as far as Mark is concerned, there's no real reason to doubt the tradition. It's very solid. There's nothing detestable about it. It makes sense in terms of what we see in Acts and what we see elsewhere, that Mark knew Peter, was associated with Peter. Well, I would think Peter would know some stuff about Jesus. And so Peter would communicate that in his preaching, and then Mark would write it down, and thus you get the Gospel of Mark. So is it necessarily true? No. Is it likely true? In my mind, I think so. I haven't found any reason to think otherwise. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's actually begin Mark now. Mark 1:1. The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Let's talk about the word gospel. What is a gospel? Well, it means good news in terms of the word. That's the basic meaning. There's a noun form which means good news. There's a verb form that means to say, to preach good news, to proclaim good news. The term gospel came to be associated with a particular form of writing. And so there's the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, the Gospel of John. You really, if you want to just go for the meaning of the words, you could call Philippians the Gospel of Paul to the Philippians, because it is good news to the Philippians. It's a very happy letter. But that never really got associated with Paul's letters, because gospel became a word about the good news, the life of Jesus. But when you see it in Mark, it is not that. And if Mark did write first, it's probably Mark's fault that that ultimately happened. So when Mark's using it, he's not saying, this is my gospel, which is a new form of Christian biography. What Mark is really saying is just the plain meaning of the words. Here's the beginning of the good news. Okay? And so, Gospel of Mark, you want to call it that as a genre, that's fine. But when Mark mentions it itself, that's not what he means. And we might as well just translate this, in the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It's not a genre. It's a word that means this is good news. Now, interesting enough, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about Isaiah. So turn there, and I want you to keep your finger there, because we're going to keep going there today until we run out of time. Isaiah 40, verse 9. Go up on a high mountain, O herald Zion. Shout out loudly, O herald Jerusalem. Shout, don't be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. One of those, and looking at the net bottom, I'm not real sure which one of those. One of those is the Greek form of the word to proclaim the good news. Which one is that? Come to me later, I'll email you about it. The idea that Mark is going with here is, here's the good news of Jesus. And if you know this word, you would have seen this in Isaiah. And so we've already seen one allusion to this prophetic promise of good things happening, of this renewal in Mark. So let's talk about the second word. Well, at least the second important word. Jesus Christ. Christ is not a last name. Okay? We tend to think of Christ as a last name. It is not. It is a title. He is not Jesus Christ. He is Jesus the Christ. That word has a very specific meaning. There was no Bob Christ, Mark Christ, Paul Christ. Not a last name. Some meanings, for example, 1 Samuel 2:10. And I did a search for the Greek word Christ in the Old Testament. You actually find a lot of usages of that word. Sometimes it just means consecrate. Like, for example, the priests were anointed. And that's what the word Christ means, anointed, which just means they were consecrated, they were set apart. You've also got 1 Samuel 2:10. Well, that's 2 Samuel. So I turned somewhere else and was wondering, you know I checked this earlier, and then I realized, oh, wait, that's Ruth 2:10. That's not it either. Okay. 1 Samuel 2:10. Okay, here we go. The Lord shatters his adversaries. He thunders against them from the heavens. The Lord executes judgment to the ends of the earth. He will strengthen his king and exalt the power of his anointed one. That's the word there, the word Christ. And so in this statement, it is really equating who is the king? Well, he's the anointed one. They are the same thing. Now turn back to Isaiah 45, 1. Now, let's remind ourselves, what is the context of Isaiah? These promises are promises of deliverance from exile, of pagan oppression, and altogether bad things, and then also the deliverance of their own sin. Isaiah 45:1. This is what the Lord says to his chosen one, to Cyrus, whose right hand I hold in order to subdue nations before him and disarm kings, to open doors before him so gates remain unclosed. If you look at what NET Bible translated his chosen one, you will see his anointed one, right? And so for Isaiah, or since this is a direct quote of God in Isaiah, for this text in Isaiah, who is the anointed one? It's the one who's going to deliver God's people from pagan oppression and bring them back to the land, which was central, of course, to the promise of Abraham. So what is the Christ? Christ is not, once again, a last name. It's another statement for God's anointed one. This is his anointed warrior, like Cyrus. This is God's anointed king, like David. It doesn't mean God. Do note that. It doesn't mean divine. It means God's chosen king, essentially. But then you get the next one, which is the Son of God. Next time, we'll pick up with the Son of God and talk about its background.